Court will proceed to the fifth case, Hardrick versus the City of Bolingbrook. Mr. Flaxman.
Good morning. May it please the Court.
We're still in the morning.
Yes, we are.
Just a little bit, but good.
Back in March of 2005, Mr. Hardrick had an unpleasant interaction with some Bolingbrook police officers. As a result of that interaction, he was charged with some offenses, and he pleaded guilty to one of those offenses, pleaded guilty to resisting arrest. Thereafter, this lawsuit was filed. The complaint was drafted before there was any suggestion that the notice pleading standard of Rule 8 was in jeopardy or had been changed or clarified or lessened. And it was a very bare-bones complaint, which was the way things were done without objection back in 2006 when the complaint was filed. Shortly after the defendants filed their answer, they filed a motion for summary judgment saying, you lose because you pleaded guilty in state court, and you lose. We then responded to interrogatory answers which had been outstanding at the time they filed the summary judgment motion. And we submitted the transcript of the state court proceeding saying that you don't really understand our claims. These are what our claims are. And based on the interrogatory answers, there are disputed questions of fact. The defendants argued, the district judge agreed, that a plaintiff's interrogatory answers are not admissible on summary judgment. That's just wrong. This court has allowed verified answers to a complaint, a verified complaint, to stand in opposition to a summary judgment motion. The district judge's conclusion that you can't use interrogatory answers should be repudiated. In a published opinion, so that nobody else makes this mistake again, because we shouldn't be here with this. We should be continuing with our discovery in the district court and even doing a real summary judgment motion after the facts have been discovered or going to trial.
Well, as far as the facts are concerned, you say that he's pleaded guilty, and I think, I don't know whether you're really trying to confine the guilt plea on what was actually charged, but you're saying he pleaded guilty to basically running away and resisting arrest, et cetera. So that's what he pleaded guilty to, as opposed to whatever, and maybe not, whatever resistance or encounter happened when they handcuffed him after that.
Well, his...
Are you really trying to divide it, or does it matter whether or not he was struggling while they were handcuffing?
Well, it doesn't matter, because in this court, the defendants say, we're not relying on collateral estoppel, page 22 of their brief. They're saying, we have no collateral estoppel claim that we're asserting in this court. They've waived that. That's a very explicit waiver. I don't understand it, but they waived it. They said, we're not raising collateral estoppel. If they had raised collateral estoppel, we would say that the guilty plea is only to what's at page 112 of the state court transcript, that he was admitting, as the evidence showed, that he did run away from the police officer. That's resisting arrest under Illinois law. The police officer was responding to a complaint about a man and a woman arguing and the man choking the woman. It was an anonymous complaint. They came upon a man and a woman, spoke to the woman, who said, we were arguing, but there was no choking going on. And then another officer spoke to Mr. Hardrick, who was detained by the officer, was patted down by the officer, didn't find any weapons. And then the officer, without any information at all of the crime had been committed, other than the anonymous complaint about man choking with no corroboration, actually had been dispelled by what the woman said, insisted on detaining Mr. Hardrick to search him for identification, because he needed Mr. Hardrick's correct name for his report. He didn't believe Mr. Hardrick had committed an offense. He just wanted to see if he had any ID on him. He was suspicious. That's our first claim about the unreasonable detention, which I think is within the complaint under the notice pleading standard as it existed back in 2006. The defendants say in this court that, well, it was okay to detain Mr. Hardrick because of this Illinois statute that allows the police officer to detain someone for purposes of learning their identification. But that statute, which wasn't argued in district court, doesn't apply because the statute requires a belief that the person is committing, was committing, or is about to commit a crime, which the officer said in the state court trial in motion, there's no crime. I just wanted to find his identification. I didn't suspect him of anything. I just wanted to see what his name was, what his ID showed. It was at that point that Mr. Hardrick ran away and committed the offense of resisting arrest. Mr. Hardrick's interrogatory answers then explained that when the officers caught him, he lay down, waited to be handcuffed, and they beat him up. One of the officers, Mr. Hardrick swears, broke Mr. Hardrick's wrist. After Mr. Hardrick was handcuffed, that same officer maced him. Those are the claims of excessive force, which would not be covered by any kind of guilty plea to anything about macing somebody when they're handcuffed.
Was you're not challenging the obviously the conviction? Your argument is that this doesn't, Heck versus Humphrey doesn't apply, that there's unreasonable force in a legitimate arrest.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. And we're not under Heck as it has now been reconfigured by the Supreme Court. We're not looking at whether it would impair the integrity of the conviction. We're looking at, are we challenging the conviction? No, it was a voluntary guilty plea. It was a deal. It was in his interest, and he's happy he made that. He pleaded guilty to resisting arrest. Whether he's guilty or not, it was a deal. Whether he really resisted or whether he didn't resist, he's not challenging that. That's over accepted, and there's nothing that would be impugned or collaterally attacked.
Okay, so it comes down to the judge did not honor the what I guess were signed interrogatories, verified, whatever, as his evidence. He said that, and he said something about it was a defense. I didn't understand that.
I think the defense argument, you'll hear it from my opponent, is that, well, since it's possible to defend against the claim of resisting arrest by saying that you're the victim of excessive force, anytime you plead guilty to resisting arrest, you can't complain about being beaten up, which I don't quite understand, and maybe the defendant can explain it more clearly because I think it's inconsistent with reality and the prior decisions of this court.
And then on these interrogatories, though, these were basically a lot of hearsay statements, and wasn't that what the problem was?
Well, I'm sorry. It's not hearsay when he says, I was laying on the ground and the officer hit me in the wrist. I was handcuffed and I was maced. He could certainly testify about that at trial. That's something he saw, perceived. That's his firsthand knowledge. It's not what somebody told him happened. It's what happened to him. He would be competent to testify to those things as a witness in court. I don't see where the hearsay comes from in that. The cases which were relied on by the district court are where the interrogatories are answered by the lawyer or the interrogatories don't have firsthand, or answered by someone who doesn't have firsthand knowledge. Somebody says, I was hit. That's not hearsay. That's firsthand knowledge. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Flaxman. Mr. Penrose?
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Notice pleading has always been notice pleading. I think this Court in the Concentra case was pretty clear that the recent Supreme Court case did not dramatically change the landscape, and we have to put this into context of what notice pleading is. It gives you notice of what the claim is. And this complaint, and I referenced the complaint in my brief, the complaint was very specific. It was very specific. It said there was an unlawful arrest, and in the course of making the above-referenced arrest, not any arrest, not any seizure, not any detention, the above-referenced arrest, there was excessive force. And it's clear the only force applied at all, let alone excessive, the only force applied was was during this handcuffing incident.
That's so, after he took off, right?
Correct, correct. So that's, if you're reading the complaint, that's the only notice that a defendant would be given. Here's the unlawful arrest, whatever we're going to call it. You might wonder if it really is a detention or a seizure claim, why we're calling an arrest, but let's put that to the side for the second. The arrest is referenced specifically with excessive force. In other words, they're both in the same box, and that's the only notice we received, and clearly that's why we moved for summary judgment, because the guilty plea, contrary to my colleague, the guilty plea was clear. It was on count two in its entirety. It was not a stipulated plea in the criminal case. And the criminal complaint was also specific. It said Mr. Hardick ran away and he struggled during being handcuffed. So he pled guilty to all that. Now you can try and say, well, I didn't really mean that, but he signed on the dotted line, guilty plea is a guilty plea.
So do you think there's ever a scenario where an excessive force claim can be filed when there's been a guilty plea like this?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, this court is held in Van Gilder and the McCann case, where that was the exact case where you had what I would call discrete events, and the criminal complaint was not as specific as to the conduct that he basically was pleading guilty to. I think those cases are clearly distinguishable, because this case, I would submit, is much more like the Okoro case, where the defendant in that case was convicted of a drug charge, and he maintained, I had no drugs. Here, we have a convicted of struggling while being handcuffed, and in this lawsuit, his claim, whether the interrogatories are admissible or not, his only evidence period is, I was waiting to be handcuffed, and all of a sudden, they beat me up. So that's where, regardless of a self-defense, regardless of anything, you have a collision course, just like in Okoro, where you can't have the two coexisting, which is really what Heck is about.
What can't you have coexisting? A conviction and excessive force?
No, you can't have the conviction in this case and his claim of excessive force in this case,
well,
because
his claim may not be valid. It may not be true. But isn't that his testimony that he says his wrists were broken in the process of being handcuffed in what I would have to say was a legitimate arrest? They were used excessive force in a legitimate arrest. Now, is that not the claim here? And don't, I guess, his interrogatory say enough that he signed, that he verified? That's what he's going to testify to. Now, the jury may not believe him, but isn't that the issue that is before us?
No, the issue is he's saying, I'm standing there minding my own business, and they beat me up, or pled guilty to that I was struggling during the arrest. You can't. Those two cannot coexist, which is really what Heck is centered on, just like the Okoro case.
Well, let's say, just hypothetically, that he wasn't struggling and they didn't like the fact that he ran off and he broke his wrist anyway.
I'm not sure I understand your question.
And they're handcuffing him. They were mad because he ran off and was being snotty or something or other. And so he's sitting there, and we'll say not, in your case, the way you look at it, not struggling, but they just twisted and broke his wrist anyway because they were mad at him.
That'd
be excessive force and arrest.
I think in the right circumstances, as compared...
Well, just that circumstance.
I'm sorry?
Would that be excessive force and arrest, or at least a proper allegation of excessive force and arrest? They were clearly arresting him, and he used excessive force to put the handcuffs on. They broke his wrist just because they were mad.
Sure, and I think that's what the McCann case points out, that if he was, quote-unquote, resisting arrest, or assaulting an officer, that in the certain circumstance didn't allow the officer to shoot him.
Right.
But that would be where the two could coexist, and I submit that this is the exact case where they cannot coexist.
Isn't that based on a question of fact?
No, it's a question on how again, according to a court.
You say he pleaded himself out of court then.
Exactly, or not even pleaded it, his interrogatories, even if you accept the fact that they're admissible, that's the way he's framed his allegations, and our argument kind of on the back end of things, just to raise, is the macing after arrest. There's some vague reference to that. It's not really clearly fleshed out. I go back again to the complaint. What's the notice? He said he was beat up during arrest. So if the mace is occurring during arrest, he runs into a problem. And if the mace is clearly applied, assuming it is, applied after the arrest, that's not what was pled. Again, the complaint, he's the master of his complaint, the plaintiff is. And if he should have or he could have said, on March 14th, I was subject to excessive force. And that would be a lot vaguer, and I would submit it still wouldn't supply with notice pleading. But at least then he would not be on the face of it crashing into heck. Here, the complaint itself says, during arrest, I was beaten up. It doesn't say after I was arrested and I was sitting in the squad car, they punched me in the head. It wasn't one of those things. It was clearly the box that was provided was where the arrest, the handcuffing, and the excessive force occurred. And that's where heck comes in and bars the complaint. The interrogatory issue, Chief Judge Holderman specifically said in his short minute order on the motion alter amend, he said, I did consider it as an alternative ground. So that's kind of an issue that's not an issue. We still maintain that stretches beyond what Rule 56 was meant to include.
Because what's your position? Affidavit should have been filed, and affidavit should have been filed versus the interrogatory?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Now, you can slice and dice that, but it's clear that this court does not need to address that question specifically because Chief Judge Holderman said, I did consider it, and I still came up with the same idea. So the fact that it was claimed that they were not considered is really not an issue. As far as the false arrest or detention, again, we come back to the same issue that on the defendant's point of view, we move for summary judgment on the only claim we could possibly see in that complaint, a notice pleading, giving us notice. And then when this new issue of the continued detention, if you'll call it, came up, we responded with my colleague's evidence that here's a transcript. It said it took 6-7 minutes. This was nothing but a Terry stop. And that's what Judge Holderman also concluded in the alternative. And I also mentioned in my brief, kind of on a backup, that even if you assume that he was patted down a second time, which the testimony in the criminal trial or the criminal motion to quash was not 100% clear, even if you assume that, it was clear that full probable cause existed right then and there because he lied. My colleague kind of makes light of the fact, but the criminal testimony is 100% clear. He said his name was Robert Carter. He said his name was Robert Hancock. He gave a wrong birthday, for crying out loud. He couldn't even figure out how to lie well enough to state what his birthday was in terms of the age he gave. So, you know, under any stretch of the imagination, full probable cause to arrest on the stop and identify statute would have been a apparent right then and there after 6-7 minutes, which was clearly a Terry stop. So he could have hauled him off to jail right then and there for not giving a proper name. So to try and claim that was somehow a constitutional claim kind of ignores that, and it's not really fleshed out by the plaintiff on their briefs. But from that perspective, and that was argued in the district court, but Judge Holderman did not reach that issue. So that's clearly a point that if we got that far, again, assuming the claim was made in the sparse complaint, assuming that you can compartmentalize this Terry stop into two searches, and the testimony was, it is just to be clear, the testimony was clear because it was only the officers that testified that they didn't really search him. They went to search him again do a little more thorough search, and the officer made an offhand comment that possibly to find identification because the guy's been lying to me for the last 7 minutes. The officer, I don't think, said, I'm searching you even because I know you didn't commit a crime, but I want to know your name, so I'm going to frisk you and pull your wallet. I don't think that was the testimony in the criminal trial at all. He did make a reference to finding, I think the phrase the officer used was a more thorough search to possibly find identification. So even if you assume all that, we're still within the probable cause parameter of the stop and identify statute. And if there's no other questions, I see my time is up.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Penley.
Thank you.
Is there really a difference between sworn interrogatory answers and an affidavit? which are sworn to, there shouldn't be a difference. Is there a difference between sworn interrogatory answers and a verified complaint, which this court has held is admissible to oppose a motion for summary judgment? Nothing in Rule 56 makes that distinction. This case should permit the court to tell the district judges that interrogatory answers are admissible, and that when they're not based on hearsay, when they recite firsthand knowledge, they should be considered in summary judgment. And this court should also take the opportunity to tell defendants that when you file an early motion for summary judgment, before any discovery, before any contention interrogatories, where the allegation of the complaint is that in the course of making the above referenced arrest, one or more of the defendants used excessive and unreasonable force, you're at your own mercy in trying to figure out what the defendant, what the plaintiff thinks. You should do contention interrogatories to find out what the theories are before you move for summary judgment. This case shouldn't be here yet, and it should be before a jury, which maybe would not find for Mr. Hardrick, but these legal issues should have been better developed. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Flaxman. Mr. Penrose. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will proceed.